Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Today will be my second time recording this because my audio software fouled up on the first recording. I've made some adjustments, so hopefully this goes all the way through. Today we're going to talk about a very fascinating story that I have heard for years. It's a story about a man who found some Egyptian artifacts, supposedly, in the Grand Canyon. Now, technically speaking, he has a professor friend of his, goes by the initials of S.A. Jordan. He goes by the name of G.E. Kincaid. Now, we're going to tell the story the way it was told to the Phoenix newspaper. We're going to kind of go through the chronology of how the story was reported without really much event, and then it was surfaced. And I've probably heard this story going back probably as far back as 2005. Then we're going to talk about some of the skepticism around it. But I thought we would take a quick detour before we actually get into it to set the foundation for how you might interpret this information. You see, these two gentlemen work for the Smithsonian. Shortly after reporting this story, people got interested. I even think they got interested several decades later, because this happened in 1909. But when this blew up on the internet, they went to the Smithsonian and said, hey, could you give us all the information you have about this S.A. Jordan and this G.E. Kincaid? And the Smithsonian said, who are you talking about? Those people have never worked for us. But they also added, they don't exist. Like, how the hell would you know, right? G.E. Kincaid was actually an explorer and fairly well-known, fairly well-published, because he would go explore something, write up a article, and sell it to, you know, any newspaper that wanted to publish it. This S.A. Jordan was a professor, not sure what he was a professor of or where he worked. I have found several elaborate blogs that talk about that they went off and researched these two gentlemen, were able to confirm they absolutely did exist. Now, I've talked about the Smithsonian when I did my episode on giants and pygmies. And what I found out was that a gentleman put up all of his money to found the Smithsonian, brought in a bunch of societies that already did this kind of stuff, sort of the gatekeepers of information, including a proxy to the Royal Academy of Sciences, which, by the way, presides over paleontology, which we'll review here in a second. This gentleman dies, but he also willed everything to his nephew, and he put in the will that if anything happens to the nephew, the whole organization goes to the government. Well, wouldn't you know it, the nephew has a short life after that. They bump the kid off, in my opinion, and they get the whole organization. It was a death sentence by a man who meant well. The Smithsonian is known and has basically, if you consider them publishing a book about giant skeletons, publishing evidence about thousands and thousands of tiny humans that were found in Kentucky and in the surrounding region, and then consistently saying, oh, but, you know, we lost the skeletons. And then later on, them telling you that these things don't exist. And again, giant skeletons ranged from 7 feet to about 15 feet is the biggest one that I've ever really seen published in an old newspaper. But these things were found in so many different locations with so many different newspapers. It's bigger than just your great uncle saying he saw a UFO because he's old and he's bored. He wants to be special again, right? He wants one moment of the 15-minute fame thing, right? And then, of course, we have paleontology, the study of dinosaurs. I got a great episode on Were Dinosaurs Real? It'll blow your mind because you can use normal sources to verify that the first two people to create paleontology worked for 40 years. I say this from time to time, discovered over 136 dinosaurs I think only 32 of which have been deemed actually real at this point. It means over 104 were complete frauds, even in the eyes of paleontology, because they were so ridiculous that they couldn't cover for them. But the first guy finds a tooth that's like 6 inches long or something like that. He goes to a drugstore and builds what basically looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex today. Small hands in the front, big long tail, big head. He completely made it up, obviously. He doesn't have the holodeck Star Trek system to take the DNA and reconstruct the being. Well, this thing sat in that store forever, for decades. And wouldn't you know it, the Tyrannosaurus Rex looks just like that being. In fact, all the dinosaurs have those beings. Have those body shapes, excuse me. We can't account for the fact that they would have to eat, you know, football fields every single day just to stay alive in terms of the vegetarian ones. In terms of how they would mate, well, how do two brontosauruses mate? Seriously? It's a completely fake science to catalyze the theory that had emerged, which was evolution. It doesn't mean evolution isn't true. It just means that these guys were willing to go to great extents to get that shoved in our brain and to subtract God out of your life. It's a sad thing, and I think really a low IQ that basically says because you find out perhaps the fingerprints of God, how the universe works, is suddenly God ceases to exist. It's a really strange thing. That's just my opinion. You could differ. I'm cool with that. So the folks that say that this is a hoax, that the story I'm about to tell you, and we're going to rip up some of the claims, you know, we're going to go through this, have bad credibility to begin with. As far as the Phoenix newspaper, very interesting evolution there. When this story comes out, you know, it's just like, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, it's for some folks very believable that Egyptians could have traveled all the way to the Americas. But we're going to beat up that as well a little bit because there's some logic there. Other things may have happened. But now they're saying that the Phoenix newspaper wasn't what it was actually publicly chartered to do, which is to basically be a local sort of Scientific American, to take things that were reported around the United States and especially locally and publish it in the newspaper so people could get educated on all kinds of different stuff. Why wouldn't you want your local community to be intelligent? This is way before... Well, I shouldn't say way before, but this is before the Hearst Corporation got into everything and made everything yellow, which is sensationalized, tabloid-level publications. Now, was there a tabloid article published before 1909? Oh, certainly, for sure. You know, the chronicles of a lot of the Western heroes, you know, they were published in comic book form, for God's sakes. And so a lot of folks in the recent days were like, well, you know, that was a comic book, but since you've never seen the comic book, it's reported in movies and television shows from the 40s up as being fact. Okay. So where does the story begin? Well, the story begins actually, interestingly enough, not just out of blue. Teddy Roosevelt was being pressured to preserve the Grand Canyon. Because by 1908, we had seen what the gold rush had done to various communities in the United States. People just got in there and just strip mined these places looking for copper, silver, gold, diamonds, whatever. And they did some quick math and said, okay, we're moving further west. The railroad track is definitely helping a lot of people move around the United States, unlike ever before. We can't have the Grand Canyon destroyed by these people looking for stuff, because they confirmed it has everything in it. If you were allowed to dig out the Grand Canyon, we'd find motherloads of gold, copper, silver, and who knows what other precious minerals, perhaps maybe diamonds and other jewels and that sort of thing. So he lays down a plan in 1908 to lock up for the sake of digging in resources and things. You can visit the place, but you can't take anything out of it. I'm going to do something I haven't done in years, which is to patch an episode that I've already recorded, because I did a little bit more research and found a giant portion of this article about G.E. Kincaid, containing all kinds of extra information that is not contained in other articles. Plus, I found a photograph of G.E. Kincaid and S.A. Jordan together. G.E. Kincaid served in the Marine Corps, and S.A. Jordan was actually an archaeologist after he retired, and apparently these two men met in the Marine Corps. It looks like S.A. Jordan might be of British military garb, but I'm not quite sure because this was a time in history where I'm not very familiar with the actual outfits that they wore. But the chamber actually has a lot more information in this particular description than the one I gave that I'm going to erase. The other thing was is that the newspaper actually was falsely claimed to be called the Phoenix newspaper when it's actually called the Arizona Gazette. It was published on April 5th, 1909. The story, in terms of its origin, holds together perfectly fine. He was sailing down the river as a result of the Teddy Roosevelt proclamation that they were going to lock up the Grand Canyon. So what's going on is that he is sailing down this river. And of course, again, he is told that there's copper, silver, gold. And there's various things you look for in rock formations to give yourself the indications that, or thank you, you know, to give yourself the idea that you're seeing indications of mineral deposits in a cliff of some sort. And that's that the sedimentary metals will oxidize and change colors, especially in the case of silver and copper. In terms of gold, you know, it can be kind of hard to see that it's actually shiny gold unless you have an educated eye. Now, the way I first heard the story was that he had seen what he thought was an indication to climb up and find out if there was some sort of mother lode in the mountainside. I guess you call it cavern side, canyon side. And that it was essentially not easy to get all the way up to where he was seeing this coming down. So he said that the streaks coming down the side of the canyon looked like it ranged about 2,000 feet in length from, you know, top to bottom. But the guy was very meticulous because he was an explorer. He's trying to, track how many steps he takes, how many feet he's going up or down. So when he told everyone in the Gazette, he claimed that it was about, very specifically, 1,486 feet up a sheer cliff. Now, they said that he found steps. One group of people said he found steps underneath a shrub, and he was actually using steps that were carved into the side of the mountain with sandstone, which I don't know if any of you have had a chance to carve that. It's the most malleable rock out there, and it's really cool. As long as you don't stomp on the steps, because you can destroy them if you just put human impact on them, they would be very resilient. But the more recent find of all of the discussion within the article, there's no mention of any steps of any kind. That he simply was able to wind back and forth, probably left and right, which is how you get into the Grand Canyon, how you get out of it, to get up to this height. He described it as nearly inaccessible, right? But the details of the cavern are actually way more interesting from this seemingly quoted article here. He says he's 42 miles from El Tovar Crystal Canyon. He says it was on the east wall, which means he must be heading, you know, north and south, when he finds what he calls stains of sedimentary formation. He said it, you know, took him great difficulty to get to the cavern entrance, which again completely wipes out the story about the steps. I like the fact that this doesn't have stories about steps because that seemed a little fortuitous, didn't it? But the size of this place is so much better in this sort of complete article. And it shows that folks either have the inability to read an article and paraphrase it to others, which is where I got some bad information, or someone has rewritten this and just fudged the facts about things. So the initial entry point is said to be 12 feet wide. What I don't have in this particular article that was submitted by a different article was that the 12-foot passage, which is hewn out of stone, goes back 57 feet but tapers to a 9-foot entrance. So these walls are kind of converging together, if you will. Now, in terms of how high the actual ceiling is, no one ever said anything about that, even in this additional article, which seems to be the original one. Hieroglyphs were said to be written on the walls. Egyptian hieroglyphs. Now, again, whether it's paint or relief, I would have to say that it's probably relief, which is where, you know, you carve it away and you leave the hieroglyph lifted so that it lasts a really long time. Because paint would simply erode with weather, temperature changes, and all kinds of stuff like that. Now, the original that I had heard about had no mention of any photography. Now, he uses the word photograph by flashlight, meaning there wasn't any light in there, so you would have to have shown a flashlight and then taken a photograph. I have not been able to find any photographs linked to this. But the actual specificity of what he finds is way more interesting. He says that when you get to the end of this 57-foot tunnel, again, he's just counting his feet. He's an explorer, probably knows how to offset things to make sure it's near 12 inches. He says that it hit a T in the junction and starts spreading off into all these rooms. But we were lacking true dimension of some of these rooms. Now, he said in a previous quote, and again, I'm a little leery about that, but this article actually encourages me because it has a lot more mention about the exploration of the actual facility and what happened after they discovered it. The Smithsonian did get involved. But he said he found several rooms 30 by 40, which he described as the average size of a living room in that time frame. It's pretty darn big, wouldn't you say? I'm assuming the kitchen's involved with that too. I'm not sure. Now, the interesting thing is that the decor is going to start fluctuating between Egyptian to the Orient. Very interesting. Because he says in one of the rooms, he found a fairly sizable altar with a character that looked extremely similar to Buddha. And that there was a lotus flower as a part of the sculpture. Now, what's interesting is we know that the Egyptians love lotus flowers as well. There's all kinds of speculation that they might have made a tea out of it, and that that tea could have had some hallucinogenic properties. And we know that a lot of the priests of Europe would take all kinds of hallucinogenic mushrooms and any other cocktail to get closer to God. And that's what happens when you take these things. Be careful not to take anything that hurts your body, right? Don't take anything from strangers, right? But in this article, it says that the entrance was 100 feet before you get to the cross hall. So 57 feet turns into 100 feet. The lilies were actually in the hands of the Buddha statue. But he says it was undoubtedly of the Orient. So you've got hieroglyphs from Egypt out front, and then you have this Buddhist statue of a god in this room. Now, of course, when things take a long time to be discovered, someone could discover this from the Orient and decide this is a gorgeous place, and we're going to go ahead and accent this with our god. If one thing the Buddhist followers can do, it is create the most amazing, beautiful statues of their god. I don't mean to insult them if they don't call it their god, their leader. They've carved it into the side of mountains. I mean, it's really breathtaking if you look up all the artifacts around the Buddhist history, right? Some of the men said, who explored this place, and I assume the T.A. Jordan guy, with a more exploratorial background, potentially in the Eastern realm of the world, they said this place looked very Tibetan in some of the areas. But it's a gigantic place. They said that the place had all kinds of artifacts that had corroded over the over time. And so they had some distorted kind of statues that didn't make it through whatever they were made out of. They had changed shape. But it looked like it was clear that they had attempted to create idols and imagery of both good and evil. They even put two cactus on both sides of the arms but it was all carved out of hard rock that resembled marble. Now, they said they found tools of all kinds, of very specific tools made of mainly copper. They even claimed to have found what looked like several different versions of weaponry, and that's fascinating. Because they did find all this different metals, when they found a room that looked like a forge, a room where they smelt it, they said that they had piles of slag in there, which would be what can't be used by the ore. So it's more of like the non-precious metal part of it. It just burns off. And I think most of you have probably seen a video or two of how we dump slag into pits these days. It's very dangerous because it's extremely hot. And I'm assuming they dump it when it's hot because it's malleable at that point, right? They had dug this bench. They left a bench, I would say, in the relief of the room. So as they're digging out the room, at the bottom part, probably about 18 inches up from the ground where most benches rest, they left the rock so there'd be a place to work and a place to sit down. And this was in the smelting room. They said another group of passageways specifically went to a series of granaries. Near the granaries, they said they found what looked like temples, but more of a Tibetan Orient origin. But they did also say that they found seeds in each one of these granaries. Be fascinating to see those seeds at this point, right? See if they can germinate and do anything, or they're just dead little husks. Now, after they have started to start counting off the rooms and figuring out that a lot of the rooms are duplicates, because a doorway in a particular area would just lead into a room that was generally the same size as the door room across the hallway, as well as the rooms that they would find down the hallway. They started just counting the doorways and doing some math, and found out that they could probably house about 50,000 people in here fairly comfortably. One of the rooms was 40 by 700 feet, for instance. But now, one of the rooms they find at the very end of this thing is actually one of the most fascinating claims about the entire story. And that is the crypt room. At the very end, they find a room. My initial notes did not have much of a description of this, but I found the original article, and it's extremely specific about what they found. And again, this is all G.E. Kincaid by himself initially. He said that there were rows and columns of basically mummies up against the wall. And it's very much like the Cyberman episode of Doctor Who when you first find the Cybermen. They're all in the walls. But what's interesting about it was I didn't know anything about how they were actually stored, what condition they were in, any specifics about the actual mummies. And the original article has all of this. What was brilliant about this was that the wall was actually set back about 35 degrees, and so the ceiling goes back a little further than the base, offering a little bit of support. And then you just need to notch out of the wall a place where the corpse, the mummy, could fit in there and not slide down to the floor. Pretty brilliant. But my question initially was, what state are the mummies in? Well, the mummies were wrapped up in normal cloth that had obviously aged, but they were also wrapped in a sort of bark fabric, he said. That's fascinating. I've never seen anything wrapped in bark fabric before. But the other interesting thing was, they said that all of the bodies that were in the corpse were male, and they seemed to be adult males. There were no children, and there were no women. So one of the thought processes was this is where the warriors were actually buried when they died. So they said that they carbon dated this, and this is where we have to get into some questions here. But they've carbon dated the bones, and they said they go back to about 1600 BC. In the article, Kincaid said that it goes back to the era of Ramses. Now, Ramses is a long line of families like the Ptolemies, of which Cleopatra came from, the Roman family. the very white Roman family. She was the ninth generation Ptolemy and the last one to rule over Egypt on behalf of the Romans. But see, carbon dating doesn't really have its mainstay in any science until the 1940s. So we're approximately 30 years before carbon dating is something that is being talked about at all. I don't know if someone inserted that. I don't know if this exploration went on for longer at different stages. But it's safe to say that in 1909, no one carbon dated any mummies. So put that in the quiver of maybe someone is lying about things. Now, he said he also found urns and cups in the lower tiers with the mummies. And that as the shelves went higher and higher, the urns and the cups actually became more and more sophisticated. This is suggesting that the chronology was that they were buried at the bottom at first, and then as the society developed more tools and capabilities, this is sort of an interesting claim there, that things got more sophisticated, the artistry got more sophisticated. Now, in order for a society to gain more artistry, let's see, could be a short time, because we know that even in American history and European history, we have done quantum leaps in artistry in just 100 years. So not completely incapable of believing that. I think it was a very interesting touch. What I'm looking for in all the claims is the lie. If you're going to tell a lie, how far would you take the lie? And how creative would you be in your ability to lie? So I'm weighing everything as I go through this with you, which we'll get into. Now, they claimed that they actually opened one of the mummies and then eventually sent it to the Smithsonian Institute for storage. They said at no point were there any bones of animals, no skins, no clothing, no bedding. But they did find water vessels. I have an image I'm going to show in the video, which is a claim of a bunch of urns that look like they're fashioned out of marble, and they look very Egyptian. They look like the urns that store the organs of the past after mummification. Now, there are heavy rituals in at least the documented hieroglyphs on how to mummify someone, and the urns aren't to travel terribly far away from the body because that's where they're kept. When you cross over the other side, you have all your stuff with you. Now, why they want to take it out of you, I'm not quite sure. But the room that was the 40 by 700 was theorized because of proximity to the granaries and some other what looked like preparational rooms as the dining hall. Yeah, that makes sense. Be a good, nice, long room for that. They said they found what looked like cooking utensils of some sort. Now, what's interesting is, in my first iteration, I liken this to the Shoshone Indians, which are a very nomadic tribe that traveled with the weather. And so they always went north in the summer to keep cooler and south in the winter to keep warmer. It turns out the same speculation, without saying the Shoshone tribe, was actually speculated about these people. Now, the other theory, and it's just literally pulled out of a hat, is that the Native Americans might have been the serfs or the servants or slaves to these people in the cavern. I don't know how you make that association without reading the hieroglyphs and having something specifically say that. It's interesting how when formal archaeology gets a hold of something, how quickly they love to insert the slave narrative into everything, right? We grew up thinking that the pyramids were made by slaves. And then when we finally started digging out the residency around the pyramids, it became very apparent that these folks lived in cities around those areas, and that if it did indeed take several years to build some of these, and again, even if one pyramid didn't take a tremendous amount of time, which we think it did, you're still building several of them. And the other thing, too, is if you could build a big rocket that went into outer space and that worked and what have you, and you're doing some really just groundbreaking technology, building a pyramid of some sort, I'm not sure how much of a slave you would feel like you are, right? You are building something that the world is going to marvel over. Imagine the pyramids finished with their veneer stones, and it's a big power plant, potentially with the gold pyrameridian stone on top. And people come from other worlds and see what you built with all the other people who are there. And they are just, you know, they feel like they're seeing a flying saucer or a time machine. It should have been absolutely incredible to see this kind of stuff. Now, the way that it's articulated is that G.E. Kincaid actually went and found all this stuff initially, documented as much as he could, came back to his friend, Professor Jordan, who then joined it with all of his intellectual knowledge. But they said they, when they both got back to this facility, so they did go back, they said they found a chamber that was way at the end of one of these long hallways. It's not clear whether or not the chamber had some sort of doorway to it. Now, there was no mention of any doors, but they said this is so far back in there. They said they got a really kind of gnarly smell, like they called it a sneaky smell. Like literally, it smells like an Indiana Jones room with tons of snakes in it. Now, again, snakes need to eat things, okay? So being, you know, in a chamber, unless that chamber relieves itself into the wild, snakes are going to have to eat something to survive. They can't just be a room full of snakes unless it's all magical, right? But they said that this room was kind of giving off a weird toxic chemical smell that smelled foul. And that both the men said the craziest thing about it was as they would hold up their lanterns and flashlights to get a glimpse of what was in this particular chamber. And again, this is one of those sort of, but wait, there's more. They said the light just couldn't penetrate the fog that was in the room. That it was very present. Almost like if you had a room full of steam, for instance, and you shined a light into it. Well, to the degree that the steam is actually taking up the cubic space in the room, it's just going to reflect off of the vapors. They said that they get a sense that the room actually had some depth to it, but the more they shone a light at it, because it was bouncing off of whatever was coming out of the room, some sort of, I'm going to say the word vapor, that it made the room immediately look tiny. And that's kind of how it would be. I'm not sure it could sustain that without generating it, so it's very interesting. Now, the fascinating claim, there's some pictures online that claim to be the doorway. The silly thing about the pictures is that if it's 1,400 plus feet up a sheer cliff, I'm not sure how these photographs have anything to do with the cavern, okay? I think somebody found potentially like a Native American cave and somebody took a photograph of it to submit it to tantalize you. Again, folks say that they've actually been to that region because it's fairly well documented. I'm not, you know, terribly versed in the Grand Canyon's anatomy. But you know how it is. If you live in the area and you explore there a lot, things become a lot more commonplace. Like, I know my way around Disneyland perfectly. So when tourists come in, they're standing in one particular area and they need to find the restroom, I know exactly where they should go and I help them out. But the claim was made in one of the articles that I recently found that this area of the canyon is indeed protected. Now, I don't know how you actually protect an interest like that, because for those of you who saw Indiana Jones 3, we all know about the Holy Grail being protected by a Templar that has been around for God knows 2,000 years, taking turns, shifting with some other guy. No one's going to be sitting in a cave waiting for people to come by. The detail of this particular description is so much more intense than the first one I ever heard. Again, the passageway, they say it was over 100 feet, not 57 feet. Now, the other description talked a little bit about the ceilings, and it's interesting that it's not mentioned here at all, but there was a quote. Here's the quote. "The passages are chiseled and hewn as straight as could be laid out by an engineer. The ceilings of many of the rooms converge to a center. The side passages near the entrance run at a sharp angle from the main hall, but toward the rear, they gradually reach a right angle in direction. Not sure exactly what that means. It means they have straight walls. And anytime you see stone that's hewn to a perfect right angle, a 90 degree turn, a perfect corner, it starts to make even the most layman of people stop and take a look. And again, the Egyptians with their basalt boxes, with a lot of other, the sort of tombs or tubs that we have found in Egypt, some at the base of really mysterious pyramids that on the outside don't look very healthy. Pyramids have kind of eroded, but they dug underneath it anyway. They find passages and they find these utterly perfect structures. Arched ceilings that predate the Romans by thousands of years. I think it's always funny that they need to credit Europe with everything. Stonehenge, right, which was obviously a pile of rocks in one area, moved in 1954, reconstructed, then some weird Druid people show up and say that they knew all about it. Like, no one knows anything about this place, but the second they reconstruct it, you have a bunch of weirdos doing a bunch of, like, semi-satanic rituals at the facility. Now, let's go back and let's think about this for a little while. Would two men create a fake article and publish it in an unknown newspaper, Arizona Gazette, in the greater state of Arizona? Sure, they would. Sure, of course. It makes money. Explorers need cash for doing things. You know, there's a bunch of Tartarian folks that look at maps, and they'll find a piece of land that was given a name, some island, some continent, and it's no longer there now that we have Google Earth. Well, we might chalk up a small percentage of these land masses might have eroded with the time since the maps were made. But one of the biggest scams they used to do back in the day, fairly well documented, was that an explorer would say they're going somewhere very formidable, very dangerous. And they're going to get money from an investor, let's say it's John Doe. And so they start naming things after the John Doe. Now, legitimately, they actually did do this, and they did find regions and start naming it after their investors. And then I guess you have to come back and register it with your country and give your cartology information to say where it is. But one of the scams was that they said they would find islands. It was a very lucrative business. But when they came back and told the John Doe about the island, they definitely litter it with, well, it's too difficult for us to get back when we got out of there, you know, by the seat of our pants. Sort of a Jungle Cruise kind of epitaph, right? Now, let's look at the entire assertion of the story to begin with. The Egyptians came to America, the Americas, before it was called that, and they set up shop inside the Grand Canyon. Now, let's think about that. Now, obviously, right off the bat, the Grand Canyon is a very unique place in the world, and it would seem like unique things would happen there. But we'd have to account for the trip of how these Egyptians would even get to America, right? Now, of all the things that has been suggested for travel, we know for a fact that Egyptians had giant boats. Now, whether or not, I'm not a sailor, I don't know that I have seen a boat that looks remotely like some sort of Magellan boat that could make it across the Atlantic Ocean, which again is the shortest journey. Seems like the most logical journey if you're coming out of the Mediterranean. Take a left and just keep going. You know, once you have a device that can pretty much erase the barriers that you've been growing up with your whole life, which is, you know, there's a big ocean, we don't even know where it goes, but you build this vessel and it's ornate and you got plenty of food, you may attempt that journey. But if you landed on the east coast of America, by the time you got to the Grand Canyon, you would be pooped, okay? In terms of you having a lot of instruments with you and a staff that's willing to work to hone out a giant cavern in the side of the Grand Canyon, I'm going to be very skeptical of that claim. So, for me, if we're going to talk about this being a legitimate story, they would have had to have achieved this journey in a pretty effortless manner, meaning they're not tired. And it can't take too long because you have to supply your team with food. The only device that has ever been suggested, and I think about it every time I see the Peruvian Indian illustrations on the desert surface, is a hot air balloon of some sort. Now, when you think about hot air balloons, you're thinking about the fact that hot air rises. And I think that through construction of various huts, playing around with fire, because fire would be literally the only show in town, right? It would be the video game of video games back in the day. That draping a piece of cloth over one, people would realize over at least a few thousand years that this hot air stuff goes up. Now, I don't know how long it would take to create a little lantern like the ones the Chinese do for their Chinese New Year and they let it float around. If someone figured that thing out, well, boy, you could start seeing it in a small manner and then build bigger ones and bigger ones until you could actually put people in them. But in order to dig this thing out, I'm talking about a serious effort. A serious effort. It's almost to the level of like spaceship knowledge of the Earth. And we have to also take into account that the hieroglyphs have been predominantly cracked. And again, they did find that subculture in, the western part of Africa that still uses hieroglyphs. And so they were able to further decipher recently in the last 10 years a bunch of the hieroglyphs that they were unaware were using acronyms. That's what this new tribe taught them, was that, well, you know, what's interesting is you don't seem to understand we abbreviate things like ATM. So the Egyptians were very romantic. They were very amazing with their storytelling. Remember, the prodigal son story is in hieroglyphs. You know, the first virgin birth is in hieroglyphs. There's a hieroglyph of this whole event occurring. So they were very well plugged into sort of the human condition, let's just say. What's interesting about what G.E. Kincaid claimed in this story was that the crypts were not, the mummies that were in this crypt were not wrapped up in any traditional Egyptian manner that we know of, meaning like a casket of some sort. Of all the pharaohs that we've ever found, there's always some casket wrapped around the mummified body. He made it sound like, and again, because there was no further exploration of this claim, that we would be having just basically really wrapped up mummies on the wall. Not sure what he saw. There's no part of the story that describes exactly the dimensions of what he saw and how they were preserved. Now, even if we go with, I'll just throw at you my theory. It's not my theory, but it's the one that I learned that apparently they taught up to about 1965 in colleges, which makes 1,000% sense to the world, the expanding Earth model. Again, the oceans, all water comes from the crust of the Earth. It's a big chemistry lab pushing hydrogen and oxygen together. There never will be a depletion of natural water in the world. Despite what they're trying to teach you, it just won't. Every time the ocean turns into clouds, it's a perfect natural desalination process, which is why you're not allowed to collect water in most of the states of the United States, because it's illegal. They're going to sell you the water, and that's it. But let's just say you get rid of the oceans. These Egyptians, who invented hieroglyphs before they actually ever built any pyramids, hence there's no mention of pyramids or how this mathematics works. Remember, to build a pyramid, you have to have all geometry mastered. You do. Trust me. Because the Greeks were the ones that wrote it down in a way that was translatable to the rest of Europe, all of the geometry typically has a Greek name to it. But the Greeks are just simply honoring the math of the temples, the hospitals of Egypt as they built their Parthenons and that sort of thing. Interestingly enough, no one attempted to build a pyramid in modern Europe. We find them in Africa, in Turkey, supposedly some in China. And, I mean, I know the ones are there in China. I'm just not convinced it's what they said it was. South America's got pyramids that are absolutely massive. But let's talk about these other pyramids in the South Americas. Because we do have Aztec pyramids. If you listen to the Aztec and Inca folks, they'll talk about pyramids that although they have collapsed, they believe that there's indicators that these pyramids were built as enclosed cities. You know, they have open doors and that kind of thing, but it was built to encapsulate 20,000 people. You know, and if it got really bad weather, it starts to rain or whatever, you just go inside. It's sad that none of them made it through that phase of architecture, meaning whatever elements happened to this, we do know that a bunch of them collapsed. In Egypt, we just have the pyramids that have exploded, right? So there's a lot of speculation as to whether or not the Egyptians or the derivative of those people ever made it to the Americas to begin with. Are pyramids a logical shape that man will always discover, or any living being would discover? My only thought towards that is that as a little kid, we all seemed to build, you know, a pyramid-shaped thing using mud, using dirt, using sand, depending on where your geographical home is. So I think there could be. But it's one thing to build it as a child and something that can just be blown away by the wind. Another thing to stack perhaps 2.5 million rocks heavier than 10 times of your, you know, 10 of your cars and get it so perfect that it pretty much lasts the test of time. Especially the ones in South America. Now, in terms of any claimed date of the origin of any of these pyramids, I'm telling you, you're smoking something if you believe anything that they're, if you buy what they're selling, basically. But now let's think about the fact that, let's say we can't solve for their travel, not even with hot air balloons. But let's just say that something makes you believe that that place was real and that G.E. Kincaid was a real guy and he really saw this. We can't explain it. That's why it's a mystery. My question to you is, would that have been the only thing that the Egyptians made in America? Now, people in the world do things for usually two different reasons, because they need to and because they can. So the question is, why would they do this? You would think that the Egyptians, as marked by their previous behavior, would be building tombs. That's just what they do. I mean the real tombs, not the pyramids that are claimed to be tombs, but the real ones. Building temples. Very interesting. But none of that really exists in this place. It was a very functional, supposed sort of city inside. Because of its amazing engineering, which does match a lot of things in South America, could be the same clan that put that together. But even the pre-Inca time construction in South America doesn't hold a candle to what was described in this article. The precision, super long hallways, right angle turns, and all that good stuff. That's some pretty intense construction. Now, has anything like this ever happened before outside of just the pyramids? And, you know, we find pyramids everywhere. We find these illustrations in Peru that most definitely have to solve for the idea that someone is elevated looking down at the land and telling someone, drop a rock, move this way, little hand gestures or something. And obviously it's a little tough to determine scale from pictures on the internet. Well, there was a story I saw on the History Channel probably in the 90s, maybe even before. Because this definitely happened before the 90s. But did you know that the Egyptologists of the world and the Smithsonian and collectors said that they found the mummy of Ramses I on display at Niagara Falls? Some of you will be familiar with this story. So I'm going to tell you that story, and I'm going to tell you one I found when I was researching my first screenplay back in the late 90s. So there is a family in Egypt that is earmarked as a family that steals and pillages tombs. The second they find a tomb in Egypt, one of the ancient ones, they would steal everything. And supposedly they found Ramses I, sold it to an Italian collector, that then, but was several years later, of course, and then that person sold it to a Canadian who then somehow got it to Niagara Falls, put it on display. I mean, you know, of course, if you want to hide something, go ahead and put it on display. I think the article I just recently read was that it was on display for the better part of 140 years before someone said, you know what, we should figure out who this is. Now, of course, claiming that it's Ramses the First is a stretch for me personally, but you know, if you even have a hair follicle, you should have some DNA in there. The history special that I saw actually claimed that, you know, there's a female in this bunch too. There's like three or four mummies in this, and they claimed that that could have been Nefertiti herself. I can't remember the exact parallel with all these people, but I'm not sure that Nefertiti and Ramses I were alive at the same time. There's definitely an amazing female mummy involved who has this beautiful hair. It's just phenomenal. Regardless of how old you might want to think these folks are, it's incredible how that stuff preserves. Another Canadian collector purchased this whole set from the Niagara Falls and then supposedly was the person responsible for contacting the Cairo Museum, getting experts to come over, sample DNA, finding out it was Ramses I. At least that one was something they believed in, and that he was boxed up and sent home to Egypt and received a tremendous, you know, parade reception from the other side. And that he's now entombed in the Cairo Museum. Now, if that's true, that is super cool. That is super unbelievable. This guy's body, I mean, he wouldn't be turning over in his grave because he would have gone on one of the greatest tours of all time, right? Now, when I was researching my first screenplay, which has an element in the 1800s, I'm researching all the old bad guys. I'm researching Native American knowledge before they learned that lying to the white man would get them money. I don't blame them. They essentially said, we don't want you to know anything about us. You guys are jerks. And so, hey, man, if you want to believe a dream catcher is a dream catcher, go ahead. We'll make plenty for you and sell them at tour shops. But if you think we're putting this over our head to catch spirits and put them into our dreams, you're sadly mistaken. And I was told that by a full-blooded Native American. That these are all, they're something, but they're not that. Now, I'm reading these books, and I used to go to the Stanford University library, or bookstore, I should say, which was a very interesting experience because you have your first and second floors that are all tourist trappy things for the students to buy, you know, a sweater that says Stanford on or whatever. And when you go down to the academic books, it sinks down a little bit, at least this room that I would always go to. And it was just gnarly books, just incredibly intense books. And so I stumbled on a story that I couldn't believe, and it has to do with the railroads. Now, my hometown is based on the Santa Fe Railroad. It actually got its name in about 1873. I think it had been around for at least a few decades before that. They had three different names going around. They finally picked this one name. So I'm familiar with the remnants of the steam engines, because when I was a kid, they would come through every once in a while. Just amazing smell, amazing sound. And then they just kind of vanish. They all turn into diesel engines. And of course, if steam was coming through, it was for some sort of display. But they had to get from point A to point B, and they'd go through our town. The smell of the burning coal itself is something that can't be described. But I'm reading this, and they said that there were so many mummies from Egypt in America through some means that they were actually using them as fuel inside of trains. And that engineers had actually come up with the phrase that if you really want to get to your destination quickly, I mean, you got to create a lot of fire inside the pit of your boiler, that nothing burned hotter than a pharaoh. Now, of course, they're not talking about real pharaohs, I don't think. So I read this whole section and I'm sitting there going, now, that, what are you talking about? You mean to tell me that someone went to the expense of picking up mummies from Egypt? Let's just say you found 60,000 mummies in Egypt. Somebody actually spent the time to ship them to America? And then somehow they get thrown away to the point they're in the back of trains and burned inside boilers of trains? It was the most bizarre thing I'd ever heard in my life. But nevertheless, it was in print. Now, I don't have any stories from my hometown of anyone saying such a thing. But it makes me wonder. It makes me wonder what Europe found when Europe came to the Americas. And why they're so afraid of the truth. That's the other super weird thing. Why take all the giant skeletons that were found all over the place, publish books with Smithsonian Institute on the back, on the spine, right? And then get rid of them. Why do that? What are you afraid of? Again, when I did my episode on giants and pygmies, you know, there's articles that go back to the early 1700s where they were talking about, you know, women that had lived 100 years telling people in the 1800s or the late 1700s at least, you know, hey, when I was a kid, they said that she, well, one woman, I think in Minnesota, if I have that right, Wisconsin or Minnesota, North Canadian region, that there were basically a dark-haired group of giants and then a redhead group of giants, and that the more that the Europeans moved in, they just kept kind of gradually going north, and that eventually the dark-haired ones killed all of the red-haired ones, and then the dark-haired ones vanished. Magellan, he said he saw tons of them in South America. He books, another dude comes back 30 years later and says, you know, in fact, Magellan, I think, only actually claimed one of them off, they got one off the beach, brought it to his boat. But when the other guy came back, this is all on my Giants and Pygmies episode. Just look up Giants on deepthoughtsradio.com. He said they had grotesque voices. He says the children were as tall as men on his, the tallest man off his boat, which I can assume is somewhere between 5'8 and 6 foot. I keep trying to rationalize in my brain, put myself in their shoes. You're an all-powerful oligarchy from Europe. What are you in fear of when you come to the Americas and you find the relics of other generations? And the only thing that keeps coming to an Occam's razor point in my mind is because you want to take credit for everything. And it's quite frankly a racial thing. Graham Hancock has done incredible research in Egyptology. And essentially, the most brief exploration of his completely negates everything that's being claimed by the current Cairo Museum. It does. Everyone who goes down there, including the authors of a book called 39,000 BC, where it's just a book full of photographs of things you never knew existed, proof of circular saws, gigantic circular saws cutting some of those rocks. And what's actually fascinating is the rocks that are smooth that we find that are just, you know, less than a 500th of an inch off after traveling, you know, 30 feet from the same rock side. The circular blades are pretty barbaric looking compared to what was the final product. The holes that are bored into rocks, when they got specialists to say, you know, what would it take to bore a 4-inch hole into one of these stones and then break off the column that's down inside there, right? Because you're going to bore it out with the circular blade. One guy said it would take about 6,500 pounds of pressure, and he says, I can tell by the way that the rivets go down inside this stone. It was done in about 60 seconds. Any slower, and it's going to look way different. The cores are going to look different. But we know that the Royal Academy of Sciences and the History Museum that's attached to that, they tried to lie that those bored out pieces were done with like bamboo or something in dust. Completely different signature. They tried to lie that the rivets weren't continuous from the top of the bored out part of it to the bottom. All proven to be lies. Lies, 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 lies. So, did G.E. Kincaid simply find one that they hadn't found? That the evidence of basically Egyptian culture was all over the world. Now, sadly, even if that were true, they must not have built any giant pyramids in the North American region that I'm aware of. Obviously, just building one great pyramid would stand the test of time. Now, I'm not sure. I know that there's ample supply of this in the United States, but they would actually have to find a quarry of the limestones that they like to use to build the pyramids, one of conductive nature, one of non-conductive nature. And we know they like to use red granite to line the inside. I think there's plenty of that here in the Americas. But maybe for whatever reason, the dynasty was ending. All that happened was they came over here to see if they could find more land. And perhaps they ran into the Native Americans. It would seem that the Egyptians, who had chariots, would be far more advanced than the Native Americans, who, regardless of, you know, their true history and their true origin and what have you, they never really found the need to create the wheel. They had found that they could drag things on sleds and it worked fine. Now, again, if there's not a need, you don't have an invention. It doesn't mean you're not intelligent. It just means there's just no need for it. But obviously, when you do get a wheel going, you have a lot of power for construction, for all kinds of neat things, right? Now, the interesting thing about the story is that, again, people aren't having any problems finding the published history of G.E. Kincaid and S.A. Jordan, but they do find a problem trying to find any additional information about them after that point. Now, back in the 1800s, there was areas of the world where you could get shot for simply snoring at night, right? Looking at a guy funny in Tombstone or Dodge City or Deadwood or something like that. Rough and tough places, probably 100 more that have no notoriety to them. When you're a professor, when you're someone of an academic nature, you tend to expect that there's going to be some sort of respect among men. I don't think in our current culture we would be unable to believe that these men would get angry, the people that are the gatekeepers of this knowledge, that someone were to publish something that is definitely a no-no. Imagine that they have, and I'm just making this up, but imagine that they had mitigated what they considered to be a risk. They got rid of anyone really finding out the giants existed, that the pygmies existed, that potentially the Egyptians had been here and done things. It seems a little far-fetched that they were able to literally scour the United States and find it all. But let's just say there's some key areas where things were built, and they sabotaged the key areas. And then these guys find it, at least Kincaid finds it, publishes it, and creates a little bit of hysteria. Now, what's interesting about it is that some citizens of today have gone out to the region which is supposed to be the place where this was found, and some of them think that they have seen something that is very similar to this opening. Now, the idea that, you know, we have to speculate, if this was real, and is reported in 1909, by 1910, if this is not supposed to exist, that place would be physically destroyed, or I would think more likely, because you don't want to completely destroy everything. Now, again, if it's just a bunch of empty rooms, they may feel like there's not much lost, but they would get the hieroglyphs transcribed down to figure out who was there, who did this, because the hieroglyphs should tell you who did it. It's unfortunate that Kincaid didn't have a camera. But back in 1909, cameras weren't little cell phone things with 4K lenses in them. They were pretty big things that you would have to anticipate needing. He was just an explorer. And of course, the chronology of being an explorer would be to search, find something, document what you found, go back to civilization, build a team, which is what Kincaid wanted to do, and come back and look at things. But what if these two guys were just bumped off? completely bumped off. And if you're in that timetable, you're a member of the Smithsonian Institute, the Royal Academy of Sciences, and you just hear, yeah, we killed those guys. That's the end of that. So now you can just deny all you want, and whatever. They got the article. It's just like Area 51 published the article about the crash of a flying saucer. I think it was on the third or seventh page or something. It wasn't even that interesting to them. And then they went and got all those papers and pulled it. When a radio station kept persisting the investigation and kept reading the article, they actually pulled their FCC license because it wasn't real, right? The Tartarian movement's interesting because people are sensing, because they're enlightened now, they're seeing more than they ever saw in these old photographs. And of course, they're seeing things that potentially aren't there. But even if they see one thing that doesn't make any sense and they're able to somehow theorize something about it, like the sacred geometry of buildings, all these regal buildings with institutions have domes on them, big spikes on them. And it's kind of bizarre that instruments that we build to harvest electricity out of the atmosphere, ether, have the similar traits. But why not build an entire building out of sacred geometry that would heal you if you were inside? Maybe even more than heal you, because I was thinking about that too. I think there is a healing property to being inside the frequency tunnel of some sort of sacred geometry location. But what if it's something else? What if it's a little bit of enlightenment too? A little bit of your pineal gland getting vibrated at the perfect frequency such that you just start becoming one with the universe. Even if you're too ignorant to tap into it, it's better than nothing. I have this incredible suspicion that most of the most magical things that we still are yet to discover in the mass population, let's just say, are extremely simple devices. Extremely simple. Something that you could teach a four-year-old to explain to adults and they would completely get it. In fact, a four-year-old might get it even better because they haven't had their mind shut by educational institutions. The big claim to fame, of course, was the crypt at the end of this journey that he did inside the mountain. Everything else was just a bunch of empty rooms. He obviously didn't have anything to transcribe the hieroglyphs, whether a piece of paper and a pencil. I could have just put the paper against a hieroglyph and scratched it. That would have been nice. This will go down as just a mystery as to whether or not it was real. It's romantic to think about sort of that old saying, if walls could talk, you know? If this room could tell stories, you know, and it's some crazy room like the ones at 20th Century Fox, all the executive rooms there have seen it all, man. All these amazing people have been in those rooms. You just couldn't imagine, right? I've been fortunate enough to sit in some of those rooms. It just has a cool patina vibe. But what if the land could talk? What if Earth could talk? And we could hear it? And all the amazing ancient history that is potentially a part of our own genetics is in there. I have an episode coming out that's going to be about whether or not humans are artificial intelligence. And the idea is all that instinctual programming that we give credit for hunting instincts and potentially maternal instincts and things, people that seemingly have no education and things suddenly start doing it with perfection. What would we potentially do as human beings if the ancient history of all of our craftsmanship started to bubble out? Imagine you're just an average Joe, an average Jane. You've lived a good life. You've got to yourself to a point, regardless of your age, where you just got some time on your hands, right? You worked really, really hard for whatever number of years, and now you just got some time on your hands. You can see some more work coming down the pipeline, but you know you got a year off or something, or a summer off. And you just look at instruments, tools, a chisel, an axe, a sander, You start looking at shapes of boards and things, and you start just having these epiphanies. Gosh, I bet you could put that together like this and that, and it could work. What I think is fascinating about mankind is that we have this invention gene. Some people have it strong. They're all over Shark Tank, the show. Sitting around, they have lived absolutely normal lives, good normal lives, never invented anything ever. And then suddenly a housewife invents the next pet rock. Something super ingenious that solves a very annoying problem. What's fascinating about the pyramids is that we have been studying those things ever since we uncovered them. And no one's stopping you from theorizing how they were built. My theory is considered to be absolutely outrageous, which is essentially coming up with some electrical field to make the rocks weigh much, much less, like the guy, I believe, did in Coral Castle. Remember, a 110-pound guy moved 60-ton rocks by himself, and not a single worker ever claimed to help him take it off the back of the truck. In fact, everyone who brought him the rocks said he made us go around the corner. Well, he did it by himself. Then we left, and the rock is on the ground outside the truck. We left, and then he took it inside. The next day, he does have pulleys and ropes to get it all in position, but he still has an electrical box on top of the pulley. He has wires going down to the rock. No one seems to figure that one out. He has a wheel made of magnets. Never had a power bill because he never bought power from the city. But he had lights on all night long whenever he needed them. Interesting, right? It has to be assumed that there's actually an institution out there that actually has Alexander's library, which we would assume would have everything that man had discovered up to that point that had been documented. But I'm sure there's lots of other libraries of similar nature. So somebody has all the answers. Whether or not they are intelligent enough to decipher what they're looking at, well, that's a whole nother game. Again, I was pulled in to look at Tesla's death ray designs. Very brilliant people had seen this before and hadn't been able to figure out exactly how it worked. It took me 5 years at least to come up with the scalar pulse solution of broadcasting the dielectric wave, making every magnetic wave you've got around conductive metal all of a sudden go to an electrical valence, and all of a sudden you got power on your phone, you got power on your computer, you got power on your light bulbs. If there's a mystery out there, get into it. Because even if you can't solve it, and you might solve it, you might come up with two or three different theories about a particular solution, but the greatest part about trying to decipher a mystery is that you're going to create neurons all throughout your brain. Because you're trying to problem solve. It'll be one of the best mysteries that you've ever touched. Better than a show on TV, I guarantee you that. And the information we have at our disposal is phenomenal. My suggestion to you is to approach all of the research about a particular subject from a very unorthodox angle. Because you can get people to answer questions if they don't know what you're really asking. You're just simply asking for little tiny truths. Remember that movie, The Fly? Especially the one Jeff Goldblum remade. There was a question, you invented all this by yourself? And his answer was this, and it's a brilliant answer. It was an answer that was given in a Twilight Zone as well. But the answer was, not really, but I knew if I could get a machine that did this, I could plug it into a machine that did that, and eventually it would make that thing over there. And so they tapped into brilliant people to solve little tiny problems for them, and this just kept stringing it all together. For me, just as an example, you take a limestone rock, which might be a trick rock. It might be a rock that you can put a sacred geometry electric pulse through to stabilize its atoms in a way that is allowing more ether to pass through the rock, thus less gravity, and you can move it into position. Now, where they would get the electricity, that's why they built little tiny pyramids before they built the big one, because they're all power stations, right? But when you look at these superconductors, you've seen it. There's a Mobius strip of a magnetic nature. It's got an electromagnetic rail running through it. And a Mobius strip is if you take a strip of paper that's like a ribbon and you cut it, then you turn it 180 degrees and put it back together. It's an infinite loop, and you will travel on both sides of the loop infinitely. It's a genius thing. Escher used to draw them. But they do this thing where they cool down the superconductor, the piece of dry ice, and they put this electromagnetic pulse through the grid underneath. And they'll talk about something called quantum locking. Quantum locking is exactly the technology that I'm talking about in order to lift a giant limestone into place. I think that's exactly what the guy did at Coral Castle. Again, there's one book of physics and runs the whole universe, okay? So you can't have one thing go in one direction, one part of the universe, and that same math is the opposite in a different part of the universe. So anyway, I hope you liked the ride here. This is the kind of subject matter that just really interests me. It's good to go through these even if you don't think they're real, because it makes you think, right? And that's the name of the game. Like, you might not like swimming, but you really like the way it works out every single muscle in your body. And so you come out looking better and better every day you swim laps, right? Anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. Everything's up there. It's a little spruced up. I did create a top picks up there. I'm still getting people asking me whether or not I shut down the Facebook group. No, I didn't shut down the Facebook group. It's now a Telegram group. It's hilarious. They'll kind of, what's up with the Facebook page? And I'm like, well, you must not listen to the show anymore. Oh, no, I haven't listened to it in a while. I will. It's just funny. God bless you guys. To the Patreon and PayPal folks, thank you so much. You make it happen. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.